It's my life I'm fighting for. It's my life I'm fighting for. It's my life I'm fighting for. You led me on a dream with no reality to try and take my pride, take my legacy. Your naked world has no respectability. I came a long way with no hospitality. It's my life I'm fighting for. It's my life I'm fighting for. It's my life I'm fighting for. I'm tired of hearing words, words of sympathy. Your own society. I'm not waiting. My tomorrow has to come. I ain't waiting. Just take a look around. Yeah. It's my life I'm fighting for. It's my life I'm fighting for. It's my life I'm fighting.
That's Leon Thomas with It's My Life I'm Fighting For. It features guitarist Carlos Santana on the song from his 1973 album Full Circle. Born in St. Louis, Thomas was known for his unique multi-tonal guttural chants. He was best known for The Creator Has a Master Plan, a collaboration with Pharoah Sanders. He died on May the 8th, 1999 in New York City. He was 62 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, August the 19th, and two things offered to you today. In the second half of the program, investigative reporter and international security expert Dr. Nafiz Ahmed warns that the Islamist insurgency in Iraq and military intervention by the United States and Britain could destabilize the entire Middle East, North Africa, and even the West. But first, legal issues pertaining to police killings generally, and most specifically in the Michael Brown case in Ferguson, Missouri, and the Eric Garner case in Staten Island, New York. We heard yesterday from Missouri, from Ya Ami, who is affiliated with a group trying to stop the violence and seeking human rights and justice. He is with the SWIP, Stop the Violence, an affiliate of the Human Rights and Justice Committee in Ferguson, Missouri. He gave us an enlightening account of what was going on at a place they call Ground Zero, which is where peaceful protesters have been corralled and have been suffering inordinate attacks by police. So I wanted to find out how he spent the night last night. Ya Ami, thank you for being with us again today. What's the state of affairs where you are?
Let me just take a deep breath and take all in first. I'd like to say thank you, Trees, for having me on the show again today.
Not at all.
Last night was another issue. Obviously, you know, we know that the National Guard's here. It's alleged that someone from the crowd threw a bottle of water and somehow it landed on an officer, and that's pretty much what kicked everything off. I wasn't there for this particular at this particular time or a moment or incident, but allegedly that's what transpired. And you know, there was more tear gas, more rubber bullets, more smoke bombs. I had people out there in the field. It was there and covering the story. It's like we saw on CNN yesterday. Don he was covering the story alive in Ferguson. I was standing next to him, And the officer, there was one officer who just kept on antagonizing the protesters and with his chest out and ordering them to get back. There was no other place to get back. We were already beyond the parameters in which they set forward. And so continued to entice him and one other officer. And then multiple police cars and other officers arrived on the scene, and they tried to insinuate that we were blocking traffic. There was traffic there. They had already blocked the streets and set up roadblocks. The only traffic was the traffic by the police in their police cars and on foot. So, again, we thank God that we were able to get live full coverage from CNN, which is something that happens rare in spite of the inconsistencies that we're getting from the media itself. So, again, these are just certain examples of what the police are doing in Ferguson to incite riots from innocent, peaceful protesters. I'm not saying that you don't have knuckleheads. They're probably implants. They're probably sent there to continue to dissolve and create tension between the peaceful demonstrators and those would-be people that are just there to divide and conquer, so to speak. You know, we know that there are undercover cops there as well, and they could be inciting this as well, perpetrating the peaceful demonstrators.
But so far, we have reports of 31 arrested, 2 shot.
Yes.
State Trooper Ron Johnson of the Highway Patrol, who's heading up the policing effort in Ferguson, says that this is largely due to violent agitators from outside of Ferguson, he says. But at the same time, we still have groups like yours unaccounted for, peaceful groups who nonetheless are being subjected to undue police action.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Yes, it's ongoing. It's ongoing. We see it every day. There are organizers out there that truly want to help. But let me say this. You know, we do have outside agitators, and we do have people that are putting themselves in a position as spokespersons. Malik Shabazz, he is not our spokesperson. I'm going to repeat that. He is not our spokesperson. Malik Shabazz of the New Panther Party is not our spokesperson.
Okay. All right, we will come back to you tomorrow, and we'll check again and get an update. But thank you so much for being with us today and giving us. I'm glad that you're safe and your folks are safe, and that hopefully that will continue throughout the night. Thanks so much. We'll check in again with you. I'll check in with you later.
Thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you. Let's turn now to some problems that are evidencing themselves in these two cases, particularly. They're not the only cases that are pending and that are current with respect to unusual use of police force and lethal use of police force, involving that in effect resulted in the deaths of citizens. Most often, those citizens are people of color and they are male. Most often, the police officers involved also are male and are white. So we have a dynamic here that has been standing for a long time. I want to say this. Today is we're going to start focusing on this case in the way that we're going to continue, I should say, focusing on the case in the way we started, which is apart from the news reports and so forth, we want to deal with the structural issues here. And that is at the heart of the matter as far as I'm concerned. I want to introduce or reintroduce the audience to attorney at war and also called the People's Attorney General, Alton Maddox, who, in my view, is one of the authorities in the country on cases of this type. He has been involved in them directly in the city of New York and beyond, but has a particular expertise in these kinds of cases. Thanks, Alton, for being with us today.
Thanks for the invitation, Utrecht.
Well, we're going to start today as a kind of introduction. We will continue this conversation tomorrow, so people should know that. But let's talk about one thing that troubles me so far about this case, these cases. You get a sense that, you know, this is a private affair that is capitalizing on public input. We don't see, I don't see that the attorneys here are conducting themselves as if this is a truly public matter. And it's as if, well, we have this case. This is our case. All we want you to do, that's the public, is show up when we ask you to show up, protest when we ask you to protest, and strengthen our hand. You may or may not know what that would mean, but it's not important that you know. Just do as we ask you to do and be on cue. But in the meantime, there's some collateral damage already accumulated here. We have lots of people in jail and waiting a bail. They don't have the bail. They've been protesting. We have people being attacked, being shot at with rubber bullets. We have people being shot at with tear gas flashbangs, and we have arrests continuing. So there is a collateral cost already being incurred, and it doesn't seem as if these folks are worried about that. It's as if, well, you know, that's just, you know, par for the course, and they're moving on. I'm a bit reviled by this whole thing, the way it's being handled. And it seems as if more and more we're getting the signal from the attorneys and the leaders in this case that this is their private matter. The public is only important insofar as they are there to shore up their hand at whatever strategy that they are pursuing. What is your view?
Well, I agree with you, Eutrice, and it really goes back to something that we unfortunately don't emphasize too much, although we have been taught differently, like persons like Dr. Carter G. Woodson, Malcolm X, Dr. John Henry Clark, and so many others, that it all starts with history. And history in the sense that you use in the past those things that have worked for you, and you try to steer away from those things that were not effective. And so there has to be an inventory taken in any movement for people who have a real steep knowledge of history. You know, I say this, and, you know, I won't emphasize it too much today, but you see, black lawyers started practicing law and being administrative boy in 1844. And at that time, Harvard University already had a law school. William and Mary already had a law school. And other institutions had law schools. And so when we started, even though there were white law schools, we were not allowed in those law schools. So we were actually allowed to learn the law by reading it and studying under white lawyers on an apprenticeship program. So that has never been rehabilitated. And so to many extent, there's a real danger there because many of these lawyers only know what they've been told by white lawyers. And so obviously, even though some of them may have been well-intended, they did not have a commitment to wipe it out, white supremacy. Now, I say that only because, you see, our movement for justice started with Robert Morris Sr. In Boston, Massachusetts in the 1840s. And Robert Morris Sr. really was the first lawyer that we had who really practiced civil rights law. And so our history starts from him. Unfortunately, most of us don't know our history, and that particularly includes black lawyers. And so, you know, I've always said that a black lawyer or any other lawyer who has an interest at heart of our people has to have the equivalent of a baccalaureate degree in black history, a equivalent of a master's degree in legal history, and a doctorate degree or its equivalent in military science. And so, you know, when you examine that, many of us are lacking. So when you don't see lawyers acting as lawyers but acting as media hounds, then that should raise red flags as to what they really there for. And I go back to the 60s because I was involved in the civil rights movement before I became a lawyer. And then obviously after I became a lawyer, I became interested in poverty law in particular, because that really spells the plight of our people. And so in that, I will say that many of the strategies and tactics that were employed in the 60s are now unknown to lawyers. So we have a real problem there. And that problem relates, first of all, trying to articulate a language that you have to employ in a struggle like this. And that language starts first with an understanding of what justice is itself, a definition of justice.
And a lot of people out there, I couldn't agree with you more. I couldn't agree with you more on that.
Yeah, and a lot of people out there who really have no idea of that, talk about everything else but that, and don't understand the definition. The other thing we have to understand is justice does not start from the bottom and go to the top. Justice instead starts from the top and go to the bottom. And so, therefore, your concern there should not be preoccupied with what young people are doing in the street at night. Your real concern should be with what is the governor of the state of Missouri doing and what is the district attorney or prosecutor in St. Louis County doing with respect to this, because that's where the problem really happens. Because, you see, they're the ones who are really instigating these rebellions. I mean, you know, we can talk about finding other people and arresting them, but these are false arrests. The people who are responsible for the people going in the streets and burning down these homes and these communities are actually the top officials in the state who are obligated to execute the laws fairly and evenly and also to execute those laws swiftly. And this is where the problem is. So therefore, until we have a language and we understand that language and we understand who are the real culprits, you know, then we're going to start fighting each other and the real perpetrators get away once again. Now,
well, this is really my problem with this, the whole direction of this case from the beginning, and that is it seemed as if from the very beginning the emphasis was let's concentrate on how much this case could pay in the end, rather than on the systemic problems, because to this date, right now, we don't have a single piece of evidence that they have legally confronted the system with, for example, the appointment of a special prosecutor or the matters relating to the actual investigation of this case. Right now, for example, we're hearing that there's going to be the county prosecutor, Bob McCullough, is talking about convening a grand jury as of tomorrow. As soon as tomorrow, they could be convening a grand jury. We're hearing from Eric Holder that he is doing an investigation.
Right.
And we're hearing from other sources that they're doing investigations. But everybody's doing it, and nobody's doing it at the same time. How could it all happen? And the lawyers, the people who are supposed to be the fulcrum, it seems to me they are the ones who should be at the fulcrum of all of this, dictating both the pace in a way and in the direction of the resources of the state and federal government and the outcome of this case, even at this early stage. They should be actively involved in calling the shots. It seems as if everybody's waiting to see whether the feds will do something. And the feds, if they do something, will they be doing something on criminal prosecution? Or are they going to be looking toward determining whether this was a civil rights violation?
Well, you see, you're absolutely right. And the thing that people have to remember in cases like this and others, you have to turn the white man's law on the white man. First and foremost, you must understand that, and you must then turn it on them in a way that they can't defend what they have created in the first place. And so here you have a situation where under the doctrine of latches, which is what lawyers should be out there talking about, under the doctrine of latches, Bob McCullough, who is a St. Louis attorney in terms of prosecution, has already defaulted his role as a prosecutor. He's already defaulted that. You know, we don't have to go and wait for somebody to tell us that. Just study the law. He is guilty of latches. He has lost his right to prosecute. And therefore, it is incumbent upon the governor of the state of Missouri to replace him. And that is his responsibility. He swore when he became governor that he would execute the laws fairly and equitably and swiftly and et cetera. He has a responsibility to do that. If he's not doing that, then that becomes a responsibility Eric Holder. When he comes out there tomorrow, just take over the whole ship and begin to start his own grand jury on civil rights violation, because obviously the state has no intention of starting its own machinery in terms of the protection of its own laws. And so now somebody has to come in and say, well, we're going to make sure at least the federal laws are protected.
The same thing with the Garner case. We have the process started, and now, of course, the Ferguson case is now dominating. But we still have this unfinished business going on in Staten Island, where we have the state already showing its cards, and the lawyers involved seem to be more concerned about what's going to happen on the long end of that civil payout tube. What's going on there?
Well, you see, this is the same thing, and people don't understand that. That's really why it is incumbent upon people to get some understanding of things before they take off and have any opinion of their own, because your opinion needs to be an intelligent opinion. I mean, you can have an opinion, but it needs to be an intelligent opinion, and that's the reason why, you know, I've been trying to say this, and I will be saying that tomorrow night at the Brooklyn Christian Center at 7 p.m. That's Wednesday evening. I'll be saying the same thing. You see, in any matter like the case of Eric Garner or the case of Michael Brown, you have two causes of action. You have one cause of action, which is private, and it can only be vindicated by the estate of the deceased, and that is a wrongful death action. That is the interest of the individual estate to make sure that those persons who may follow the deceased will be given some type of compensation. But the greater issue is not on the family of Eric Garner. The main issue is a public right, and that's the right of the public. That precedes what any family member says. We don't need to wait for family members to tell us anything, because, you see, in a criminal prosecution, it is always entitled, for example, New York versus some cop, or it is entitled the state versus some cop, or it is entitled the people versus some cop, or in the federal court, it is entitled the United States versus some cop. And therefore, you are talking about an issue now that involves us all. We all have a stake in the enforcement of the criminal laws, and we have a stake in terms of how the criminal laws are enforced. And therefore, if we believe, for example, that Staten Island is not the proper venue to impanel a grand jury, then we have the responsibility to demand that Cuomo get off his horse and actually enforce the law in a way that a fair and impartial grand jury can be impaneled somewhere else in order to bring about these indictments.
Well, this is ground zero, if you will, in both these cases and in similar cases, where the lawyers step in, and we see it happened in the Trayvon Martin case.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to say,
yep.
We had a big concentration on the big payout. And I am making it clear, I am not saying that I object to the family being compensated for the loss of a loved one. Understand me well. But I am saying that the attorneys here have usurped the investment of the community and are manipulating the public into shoring up that end of things, but they are neglecting and have neglected the obligation and the duty, I would say, to make sure that they pay attention to the overarching issue of the public good. Since the Trayvon Martin case, how many other cases have we seen in Florida alone, let alone the country, and cases where black folks have been done in by the Stand Your Ground law? But there is no record from the Trayvon Martin case as attributed directly to the attorney involved, that they have filed any notice with the state that they intend to fight this law.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you know who did the work? A ragtag group of very courageous college students who took over the governor's office and sat in and compelled the governor to have a meeting with them. It took them more than 2 weeks to get that done, and to shame the legislators, the black legislators in Tallahassee, that they just didn't do anything about the Stand Your Ground law. And then you had the cameo appearances of people like Jesse Jackson. They showed up to say, oh, well, we approve of what you're doing, which is not the point. The point is they didn't do it. And these were the young people who took on the fight. And we're seeing the same thing happening in Staten Island. We see the same thing happening in Ferguson, Missouri. And there are a whole string of cases where the lawyers are involved and the so-called leaders are involved. And they're acting like, well, this is our private business. We only need the public to know only insofar as we need a public showing which will shore up our hand and our profiles as leaders or as professionals in the field. But beyond that, we don't see any evidence that they're doing the work.
That is absolutely correct. And, you know, let me just say, so in the last few seconds that we have today, that Benjamin Crump and his partner Daryl Parks, Daryl Parks particularly, was head of the National Bar Association, which has several thousand black lawyers in it. And not once did he ever ask anybody in that legal organization to take some action against the state of Florida and its Stand Your Ground law in vindication of the rights of Trayvon Martin.
That is most disappointing. Well, give us a preview of where we are going to go tomorrow. What are you going to be presenting tomorrow? What will be the focus of our discussion?
Well, the first thing we have to do, well, in order to, before we get to tomorrow's tree, the first thing we have to do today is to secure the release as a hostage of Ramsey Order. And so there are bank accounts that have been established in Carver Federal Savings Bank, and there's a bank number that people can use for that account to make deposits. The Occupy Wall Street has contacted me and said they would co-partner a release of Ramsey Order. My point is instead that the black community, with $1 trillion at its disposal, if it cannot gain the release of Eric Order, then we all need to be whipped severely. Because it is a real dying testament. So my point is, I don't care who you are, if within the sound of my ears, run to Carver Federal Savings Bank today and give everything that you possibly can in terms of this bail fund. If you need more information, call 917-947-8994. That's 917-947-8994. But tomorrow night, we will order released, and we will have him at the Brooklyn Christian Center in Brooklyn at 7 p.m. to celebrate his release.
Now, we should describe who Orta is.
Yes. Orta is the material witness in terms of the death of Eric Garner, the chokehold death. He had videotaped it. It's on videotape. The problem that people have to understand about a videotape machine is that the videotape itself is not admissible until you lay a foundation for its admissibility. And its admissibility requires the presence of the person who took it in the first place to lay the foundation and answer certain questions that would make that videotape admissible. The New York Police Department is holding Archer in hostage to make sure that he never gets an opportunity to testify against the police department through his camera.
He is facing a $75,000 bail on a charge of possession of a gun?
That's correct, and there is no probable cause for it, but we're not going to debate that issue now. We're going to debate that in September when I show up in court to represent Order. But in the meantime, I'm asking everybody in the sound of my voice and every preacher that we are writing to now to get busy, and by tomorrow morning, you cannot tell me that Order should not be released. And again, for further information, that's 917-947-8994. That's the Freedom Party headquarters.
The significance of this case is that Ramsey Orta, as the videographer Alton has just explained, the video without the videographer is not admissible in a court of law.
No, it's not.
And so he will have to be available to appear before the grand jury. He has been removed by being confined to a jail, but under what anybody would say is onerous bail, $75,000 for possession of a gun, which I understand was also unloaded.
There are no fingerprints, there are no camera to tape the transaction that allegedly occurred, even though there was a camera present, but it doesn't show him committing any crime, and he's been held on no evidence and a frame-up by the New York Police Department and by the PBA to silence him.
So he is basically in their grasp, and in that regard, people have concerns about his very life. He is not available to people who know him, and so the effort is to have him released. I must mention here that this, too, was dismissed by the National Action Network that had him there at one point, praising him for having the courage to film this entire event that claimed the life of Eric Garner. But upon learning that this is what has happened to him, there has been no contact and no attempt to even enter into conversations, even with what has happened to Ramsey Orta.
No, that was a court appearance this week. The National Action Network, no member of the family or anybody else was present. The only person that were present was a member of the United African Movement, and we have staged this attempt now to get him out by tomorrow, and everybody within the sound of my voice can participate by going to a bank right now, Carver Federal Savings, and making a substantial donation. And the telephone again is 917-947-8994.
All right, we'll leave it here for today, Alton. We'll again pick up tomorrow, and I'm hoping that the audience appreciates what is being attempted here. I don't like the idea of trying to compete, and I don't, with news that, oh, this is happening now and that is happening now. That has never, ever been my approach in my years of journalism. I'm interested in helping people get a structural understanding of what a problem is so that you can then make sense of everything It's not about, well, ABC News said this, and therefore I should feel compelled to say that. We're not there. We're interested in, this is an educational process. People need to understand what the elements of these cases are, how they fit together, and how they are manipulated in order to achieve a predetermined outcome. And so with this information, you can act more intelligently and react more intelligently to these cases and to when information about these cases is presented to you in order to persuade you to act in a predictable way. That you are armed, you understand the components, you can see how the systems work, and you can see, therefore, when we discuss these cases in the way we will be discussing these cases, you can see why it is not an outlandish charge to say that the system is racist. It is not an outlandish charge to say that the system is oppressive. It is not an outlandish charge to allege white supremacy here. You see, this is what we're trying to get to the bottom of. And it's it calls for being open to understanding these things, so that you can appreciate when people are reacting and you think, well, you know, the typical way to interpret their reaction is, of course, literal. Oh, my God, these people are violent. They must be genetically predisposed to violence, or they're just being unruly. No, you see the systemic issues, and you get from the observation even from last week when we talked about the state crimes against democracy. You see, this is what is happening. So you begin to make sense of your universe in a different way. Thank you so much, Alton, for being with us today. We will
Thank
reconnect
much,
again
Dietrich.
Tomorrow and get to dealing with some of the substantive issues here, the basic foundational issues that are coursing their way through all of these cases and that so far have delivered the predictable results. And it is time, this is the time, to interrupt that cycle and to put it at rest. To just say this is beyond this point, we will have an entirely different way of operating and thinking. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Treese. See you tomorrow.
All right. We'll take this break and come back to some more thoughts right after this. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM, I'm Eutrice Lead. Our guest apparently is caught up. He's his book is being released this week, and he was supposed to be in studio by now, but I understand he's caught up. He's Dr. Nafees Ahmed, and we will probably try to reschedule so that he can be with us to discuss a very important subject about the Islamist insurgency in the entire Middle East and North Africa and repeated interventions by Europe and the West as setting the stage for a global apocalypse. Very heavy subject, but apparently he is delayed in getting to the studio. But let's therefore continue the conversation, and I want to make myself clear about certain things. It bothered me when I read today that we see all these pieces happening, and it is all predicated on one thing, and that is the death of black men. The death of anybody by police, brutal force, should trouble everybody. But we're talking about a consistent pattern. And as I said before, when something happens consistently, and happens consistently over a very long period of time, it is as good as fact. And it is good that the president is animated about this. He's become involved in that, and people are acting, oh my gosh, isn't this great? Barack Obama is actually responding to the black community, and for that we should be grateful. And I say, well, you know, fine, if that's what you want to think. Here's what I think. This, too, is the reason for the heavy investment African Americans have made in this president. So there's no favor being done here. Frankly, I think he is involved because it has dawned on him in year six that there is a huge distance between him and the community that brought him into power. And that is by his own doing. That is why his volition and the design of people to whom he is answering. So I'm glad that this has served as a wake-up call of sorts. But it is the tragedy all the more that it takes this to bring the president closer to his political base. It's unfortunate. And even so, I mean, he's gone as far as he diplomatically can go. He can't be too black now. So he's been measuredly black in terms of identifying with the humanity of the situation. He still has to keep it in check so as not to frighten white America. I'm not being too black here. I'm just being mildly black. Okay? We get it. We'll take it. But let's not be disillusioned about it. The second thing is, and I'm coming back to the role of the lawyers and the so-called leaders, people like Sharpton and Jackson and others, who have hijacked this thing called the civil rights movement. I remarked about it many times before, about the commodification of suffering. The entrepreneurial endeavors that are predicated on the suffering and death and pain of black people. You have these folks who have imposed themselves as leaders, as the go-to people, the people who are, quote, in charge of they're the in charge, that's their portfolio. We are in charge of black folks. So you can't talk to black people unless you come through us. Well, okay. If that's what you have decided that you want to do, then you can't occupy that position and still be private about it. You are now to be publicly accountable. You are to account to the people, since it is on the people that your entire profile rests. You are now important to the Democratic Party because you have fashioned yourself as the person who keeps the lid on the community. You are the go-to guy or the go-to guys. So why should you be able to enjoy this privacy, this shield, that nobody is to know anything else beyond the fact that you can pop up behind microphones whenever you decide to, and you call news conferences, and you are transacting business in the people's name. And look what we've gotten. The same lawyer who was involved in the Trayvon Martin case is involved in the Michael Brown case. And we see the same pattern. I am not opposed to anybody making money. I'm not opposed to anybody achieving professional acclaim. But I'm saying, if you're going to present yourselves as as representatives, not just of the people, but of the aspirations of people and the necessities of people, then you have to do business in a different way, or else get out of the way. If this is your personal business, if this is your personal case, then shut up. We shouldn't know anything about it. But you're out there calling for people to demonstrate. You're calling for people to take specific actions. You're calling for people to do things that are getting them arrested and they're putting them in harm's way. And you're not taking responsibility for that. But you are taking the credibility of all of that strictly to enhance your personal and professional private endeavors. Now that's where we have a problem. If this is your personal business, keep it personal and shut up. We go away, do your thing in private. You know, Trent, go to court and do your thing privately the way all other lawyers do. But when you make this a public matter, and when you deliberately seek the input of the public in a particular way that is even harming them, and you walk away from that and you dust your shoes off and you say, well, that has nothing to do with me. I got what I wanted. I got the press to show up. I got the coverage that I needed. I got the television lights shining on me. I got my moment of glory. And that will now help me. That will now builds my currency to in the white world, where basically I am positioning myself as the middleman. That is my business. I'm now in business. I can help you deal, quote unquote, with the black community. I can take pressure off and I could apply pressure if it comes to that. But this is my own private business. So these folks are trading not only on the energy of the community in this way, without giving anything back, but they're trading on a history. And this is what is so profoundly offensive. They're trading in on a history of struggle in which people put their lives on the line, their lives, their livelihoods, their reputations, their families, all on the line in the name of progress and in the name of freedom for their people. And in so doing, the struggles of Black America have humanized America, all of America. Let's not forget that. The struggles of Black America have humanized all of America. That is what I played a tape of Adam Clayton Powell saying, that the world measures America with the black yardstick. They measure America in terms of how it is dealing with black people. And we don't want to be monogamous here. We don't want to just say that this is just only for black people. We know Native Americans suffer terribly, people of color generally in this country. But the struggles of blacks have taken a special place in the narrative, the historical narrative and the social narrative, the economic narrative, the international narrative of America. There's no question about that. So when these folks come around and they roll up to the demonstration in their air-conditioned limousines, and they come out to their news conferences in their fine Italian-cut suits and their silk ties, and they're now discussing these issues as if they are merely theoretical questions, and they're not saying what they're about, and what they truly are about is offensive, basically. You have no guts, you have no intention, you have no care about saying, you know what, part of what we're doing here, we have got to take care of what the calling is here. Yes, we take care of the issue, the instant issue, but we know that the larger picture is to put in place those structures that make it impossible or close to impossible that these things would happen over and over and over again. But they've abandoned that. And deliberately so. And with the full expectation that there is to be no accountability for it. They are betraying this history, which should be sacred. This is a sacred trust. This is not something that you play around with blithely. This is not about how many news conferences that you can have. This is, at the end of the day, can you show that you have actually engaged in struggle with your nice Italian suits and your silk ties? It should bother these people that this is where they have come. It should bother them even more that this is where they have placed their people, as automatons running out there, because they sincerely, this is what kills me, people sincerely want a change. And anybody who asks them to lend a hand, they don't even question it twice. They trust that the leadership is up and up, that they're honest and forthright and committed, that there's integrity there, that they are observing a long-held history of obligation, and that they're doing, this is just their turn at bat. They're doing their job. And the evidence will show they made a remarkable effort at staying true to that history. But no. These are sharks and predators. These are entrepreneurs. These are people who see that they could make a ton of money, and they do. And I have no problem with people being successful, making a lot of money. But not this way. And if you're making money this way, expect to be called out. These are very serious times. The FBI's own figures are saying, on average every year, 400 people are killed by police. And even the FBI's own figures, they're saying, are underreported. 400 people a year. And you're futzing around like this and making a spectacle of things. And where we need your hard work, and where we need you to really show off, it would be a joy to have you show off with your silk ties and your Italian suits and a ton of legal briefs that said, I compelled the state to do something different, and we won. No such work. You have no intention of doing that kind of work. So let's get the gullible people, the same contempt that white America historically has had for black America. I'm talking about the systems. The same contempt you now have. You can make black folks do anything at your command. And instead of understanding that as an exquisite privilege that is never to be betrayed, you delight in the idea that you have that power, and you use it specifically for self-aggrandizement. Shameful. absolutely shameful. And that is why part of what should happen in these cases, and the opportunity presents itself for the community as a whole to really do what I just described as forensic auditing. You match your receipts against what you got for spending. They're not adding up. There's a deficit. And the job now is to remove from our misery the people who have become impediments to progress at all levels. But first, we have to be honest about it. We have to be honest about it. This is not a joke. And then, you know, with people still in jail, and you get back in your air-conditioned limousines and you ride off. You're right out of town, onto the next gig. And you leave all that suffering, added suffering behind you. And it is none of your concern. That's what we have. And those actions are the trademark of predators. These are not the actions of people who have a love of community or a sense of obligation to the community. These are the actions of people who have a sense of obligation only to themselves. So we will discuss these cases in this light and come to a different understanding so as to come to a different way of acting and thinking. I want to thank you for joining me today. I hope this program in some way served a good purpose. Let me know. You can drop me a note at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Stay tuned. Coming up right now, The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. And thank you for the pleasure and the exquisite privilege of your company.